Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a resident. This is episode 139 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in today's episode, I will be talking about, I will be beginning a series that relates to a comprehensive pulmonology review for the USMLE Step 1 exam. I know some of you may be saying that, oh, Divine, but you just put out a podcast fairly recently that related to pulmonology. That was more for Step 2 CK. Remember, the Step 2 CK exam is a lot more clinical than Step 1. So, in that podcast, I talked about pulmonary physiology, but I talked about it in a very heavy clinical context. So, I would say that if you're like a first or a second year medical student listening to this podcast, that podcast may actually not be a terrible one to take a look at, because essentially we'll bring all these concepts that I'm going to explain today to life. It would essentially just give you all this basic science, whatever that I'm learning, actually relates in some way, shape or form to things I will see clinically as a resident or as a third-year med student. And the episode I'm referring to here is episode 129. That's also part of another series, again, that I'll be continuing in the future. But again, it will be a clinically focused series because that is targeted more towards like Step 2 CK and Step 3. But again, I promise you, if you're a person that's, pre-Step 1 or studying for Step 1, you will get a lot from that podcast. I think it's a fairly well-made podcast. So, today, I'm going to begin a pulmonology series, and I will sort of take a somewhat atypical approach. Because the thing is, POM is one of those things that many people think they truly understand, but they actually unfortunately don't. And again, I'm not going to get into like a contest here, but the thing is, at the end of the day, POM is probably one of the hardest bits of physiology for medical students to understand. So most people just, memorize the big picture things and say, okay, I'll be fine and set for my class exams or for Step 1 with this stuff. But I'm going to take the approach where I really want you to understand how to think about pulmonary physiology and pulmonary pathology. So I would really try my very best to explain things the best way I can. Because I know sometimes people may say that, oh, Divine, POM is heavily based on physics, so it's kind of hard for me to understand. The thing is, if by the end of these series of POM podcasts, I will try to explain things so well that even if you're not a physics person, you will have like a very detailed, thorough understanding of the pulmonary system. So with that said, I'm going to get right into it. And the thing is, to begin to learn POM, unfortunately, one thing you would have to, kind of commit to memory are your lung volumes and lung capacities. I'll encourage you, if you're listening to this podcast, maybe go ahead and pull up the first aid page that talks about these lung volumes. Kind of like the big ones to know, right? It's kind of easy to remember. There's four volumes, there's four capacities. And the thing is, capacities arise from the combination of, two or more lung volumes. So let's talk about the lung volumes first, and then we'll talk about the lung capacities, right? So basically, if you're taking, just quiet breath, like you're inspiring and expiring without even thinking about it, you're essentially breathing in and breathing out tidal volumes, okay? Just like your regular respiration, you're not like trying to force yourself to breathe in or force yourself to breathe out. You're just, breathing like a normal person that's not being chased by a lion. Your tidal volume, you're essentially breathing in tidal volumes. And usually that volume tends to be right around like 500 cc's, or for people from other countries like Nigeria, where I'm originally from, 500 milliliters. Now, if, for example, you say, I want to breathe real hard inwards. I want to like inspire real hard, right? Then if you're inspiring real hard, you're not going to only be breathing in those tidal volumes. You're going to breathe in something above that tidal volume baseline, okay? you're going to be breathing in something above that tidal volume baseline. That thing you're breathing in above your tidal volume baseline is something called the inspiratory reserve volume. Okay, so that thing you're breathing in above your baseline is what's called the inspiratory reserve volume. And I guess I will just slot in one of the capacities right now. If you actually add up that tidal volume and then the stuff you inspire above that tidal volume baseline, which is the inspiratory reserve volume, you essentially have something called the inspiratory capacity. Okay, so the inspiratory capacity is essentially the combination of the tidal volume and the inspiratory reserve volume. Now, let's take things from the other juncture, right? So let's say, you know, you're taking in your quiet inspiration, expiration, and you say, you know what, I've expired out my tidal volume, but let me try to expire some more. Let me see how much more air I can blow out. If you blow out more air beyond like your baseline, like air that you blow out with your tidal volumes, that's something called your expiratory reserve volume, okay? That is something called your expiratory reserve volume. And the thing is, if you actually go ahead and blow out that extra air beyond what you would ordinarily blow out in a tidal volume, there will always be some small amount of air left in your lungs. You can never truly blow out all the air in your lungs. You just can't, right? So that small amount of air left in your lungs, you almost think of it as like, you know, your lung is like having your lungs essentially has like a savings account, right? Like a reserve fund. That's something called your reserve volume. Okay, so again, just to sort of summarize what I've said already, if you're breathing in and out like normal, like a normal person, you're not being chased by a lion or anything like that, that's your tidal volume. If you inspire some more above that baseline tidal volume, that's something called the inspiratory reserve volume. The combination of your tidal volume and your inspiratory reserve volume is your inspiratory capacity. Now, if you decide that, okay, you know what, I've blown out air, you know, like normal, right? So I've blown out like a tidal volume's worth of air. But you know what, I want to blow out some more, see how much I can get out of the lungs. That extra amount you can blow out or expire above your tidal volume is what's called your expiratory reserve volume. But I said that your lungs is like a bank, right? Let's say your lung is a wise person. It doesn't want to spend all its money and have nothing left. Your lung always has like some reserve, like some savings. That's what's known as the reserve volume. And it so happens that if you add up that extra amount of air that you blow out beyond your tidal volume, and that little amount of air that's left behind in the lungs that you can never truly blow out of the lungs, so basically like your expiratory reserve volume plus your residual volume, you have something called the functional residual capacity. That functional residual capacity is something that's very important, but I will talk about what establishes it sometime down the line in this podcast. Alternatively, you can also say that, you know what, oh, if I take all those volumes that I've talked about already, the inspiratory reserve volume, the tidal volume, the expiratory reserve volume, and all I'm just left with, if I essentially say, oh, let me take all those volumes, but not include that savings of the lung, not include like the residual volume of the lung, then that's something called the vital capacity. The vital capacity is essentially every lung volume added together, that is, but it does not include the residual volume. I almost think of it as like the disposable income of the lungs. Like, okay, the lung says, you know what, let me blow out everything. If he blows out everything, again, like I said, there'll still be savings. If you don't include that savings, but you're just saying, oh, what were all those things I was able to blow out? That's your vital capacity. And then if you're like, oh, let me add up everything, you know, let me take that vital capacity and include that savings, the residual volume of the lung, right, then that's the total lung capacity, kind of like the total amount of stuff that you have when you talk about your disposable income plus your savings. Okay, so again, I talked about the inspiratory reserve volume, inspiratory reserve volume, tidal volume, basically the way I built this construct, because it's kind of like the means I used to remember this. I started with the tidal volume, and then I added an inspiratory reserve volume on top of that. That's inspiratory capacity. Those are three quantities. And then I talked about blowing out extra. That's your expiratory reserve volume. Those are four quantities. And then I talked about the amount of oxygen that will be left in the lungs after you've blown out everything. That's reserve volume. Those are five quantities. And then I said if you add that expiratory reserve volume to your reserve volume, that's your FRC, that's the sixth quantity. And then I said if you add up all the lung volumes with the exception of the residual volume, that's your vital capacity, that's the seventh quantity. And then if you just add up all the lung volumes, basically your vital capacity plus your residual volume, so like your lungs disposable income plus your lungs savings, that's your total lung capacity, that's the eighth quantity. So again, those things, I promise you, they're very high yield. They're very, very high yield to know for the USMLE step one exam. And also if you're taking like a, you know, like a preclinical like POM exam, it's something you also want to know, right? It's something that is like easy fodder for tests. And the thing is, I said I'll talk about the functional residual capacity. I'll talk about, kind of talk about it in layers as I go along. But basically, your functional residual capacity is the equilibrium point of your respiratory system, okay? It's the equilibrium point of your respiratory system. You'll see what I mean in a second. Now, the next big thing I think I want to go ahead and talk about is something called the dead space. Okay, something called the dead space. There are many types of dead spaces, but I think it's probably imperative to understand what is dead space in the first place. The thing is, by definition, dead space is something that does not participate in gas exchange. Okay, dead space means this thing does not participate in gas exchange. Because for gas exchange to happen, I kind of think of it as a marriage, right? Marriage, you have like an exchange of vows between the man and the woman, right? So two people need to show up for you to have that interaction, right? For you to have that exchange of vows. The same thing happens in your respiratory system. You need blood to show up, but you need air to show up as well, right? So if, for example, there is a lot of blood, but there's no, I mean, there is a lot of air, but there's no blood around to exchange that air with, then you essentially have dead space. Okay, so dead space is space that does not participate in gas exchange, right? So what's like the first type of dead space? The first one is something that people call the anatomic dead space. Basically, the anatomic dead space constitutes like the non-alveolar parts of your airway, right? So basically, like all those tubes that connect to your alveoli ultimately, right? They are parts of your airway, but they are non-alveolar parts, essentially, right? So these things, right, that whenever you are, you know, taking in a deep breath or whatever, these things all contain air, right? But because there are no, there are not necessarily blood vessels around them, right? And they are like non-alveolar parts. They do not participate in gas exchange, right? Essentially, everything from your terminal bronchioles upwards to like your mouth constitutes your anatomic dead space. And one easy thing to remember here is that your anatomic dead space is about like in, is about the same as your weight in pounds. So if you have like, if you're like a 100 pound person, your anatomic dead space is right around like, is right around like 100 cc's, like 100 milliliters. And really, for the most part, if you want to think about it roughly, this anatomic dead space is essentially like the conducting zone of your airway. Now, if you then say, you know what, instead of talking about these tubes that connect to my alveoli, let me talk about like just my alveoli itself, but talk about alveoli that are not participating in gas exchange. When you're talking about like the alveolar parts of your airway, so notice I said that the anatomic dead space are the non-alveolar parts of your airway that do not participate in gas exchange. That's your anatomic dead space. If you're talking about the alveoli, right? So the alveolar parts of your airways that do not participate in gas exchange, that's what's known as the alveolar dead space, right? So basically, your alveolar dead space, the alveoli that are, you know, they are rich in air, or they kind of like lack surrounding blood flow to enable gas exchange, right? So if you really think about it, these alveoli, let's maybe give it like a practical purpose, right? If a person has like a pulmonary embolus, right? You have an occlusion of a vessel that's around the alveoli, right? If you have a pulmonary embolus, those alveoli that are around that pulmonary embolus, they will have air in them, but they will not be capable of gas exchange because blood is not coming in that direction. That's an example of alveolar dead space. And if you really wanted to think about it, those alveoli, that constitute part of the alveolar dead space, what should be true of the P big A CO2? So I guess let me maybe backtrack here for a second. Whenever you see the term big A, it means you are dealing with the alveolus. Whenever you see the term little a, it means that you're dealing with blood vessels, something that's happening in like in the arteries, for example. So in alveoli that constitute alveolar dead space, what should be true of the P big A CO2? So what should be true of the like the partial pressure of carbon dioxide in those alveoli? I would hope you're telling me that it's zero, because yeah, it's not fully accurate, but it's technically accurate. Because the thing that happens is the primary source of carbon dioxide for your alveoli is the carbon dioxide that's coming in from blood. So if blood is not flowing around an alveolus, then that alveolus will have no carbon dioxide in it. So the P big A CO2 for the alveoli that constitute your alveolar dead space is zero, right? If you wanted to, you know what, maybe I shouldn't talk about this further so I don't confuse you further, right? So that's what I will say. And essentially, if you decide to add your anatomic dead space to well, you know what, let me go ahead and say this. You may hear this sentence thrown around a lot, but it's a simple sentence, right? They'll say, oh, dead space, alveolar dead space is like alveoli that are being ventilated but not perfused. That's just essentially like a different way of stating what I've already just said, okay? I just wanted to throw that sentence in there because I know it pops up in many resources, but it's something people are like, what exactly are they talking about? Now, here's the deal. When you add your anatomic dead space to your alveolar dead space, you have something called the physiologic dead space, okay? So your physiologic dead space is a combination of your anatomic and your alveolar dead spaces. So let me ask you a quick question. What should be the ideal situation in the respiratory system? The ideal situation should be that your physiologic dead space should equal your anatomic dead space, because ideally you would want all your alveoli to be participating in gas exchange, right? Because I mean, that's their job, literally. That's literally their job, right? So what must I guess be true when the physiologic dead space exceeds the anatomic dead space? Well, it means that there must be parts of a person's lung that are being ventilated again, but they are not being perfused, right? Because again, normally, like I said, your physiologic dead space should be the same as the anatomic dead space. And you may be saying, Devon, you're repeating things over and over again. I'm just doing this because again, pulmonary physiology is a touchy subject for people. So I want to make sure that you really understand this stuff. Because the thing is, the way I'm trying to structure this podcast, and I'm going to try to structure things to kind of build up on each other. Now, the next thing I guess I will talk about here, again, I'm just using this to lay a foundation for the future pulmonary podcasts. So what is minute ventilation, right? You've probably heard this term, minute ventilation. What does it mean? Basically, minute ventilation just means your tidal volume multiplied by your respiratory rate, okay? Your tidal volume multiplied by your respiratory rate is essentially like, oh, if you're taking in, you know, just normal breaths, those tidal volumes I referred to earlier, if you multiply that number by how many times you breathe per minute, that's your tidal volume, right? I mean, that's your minute ventilation. But the thing is, for purposes of the USMLE Step 1 exam, you want to be able to differentiate minute ventilation from alveolar ventilation. Alveolar ventilation is like ventilation that is like true high yield ventilation that gets oxygen into your actual body. So what do I mean by that? I essentially mean that in alveolar ventilation, you're dealing with ventilation that you've removed dead space ventilation from. Okay. So it's like, if you're like, oh, mini ventilation. Yes, that's great. That's like my total ventilation. If you subtract the component of that mini ventilation that is occupied by dead space ventilation, you essentially have alveolar ventilation. So it should make sense already that your alveolar ventilation should be less than your mini ventilation, right? Because it's like mini ventilation is like, oh, tidal volume times respiratory rate. But your alveolar ventilation is like tidal volume, you subtract like your dead space volume, you get a number, and then you multiply that by your respiratory rate. And I guess it's kind of useful to know some like values for like tidal volume, right? I already said earlier that tidal volume is about 500 cc's. Dead space volume, for the most part, is about, let's say, you know, like the classic 150-pound male. Let's say like 150 cc's. Remember, I told you that your dead space volume usually sits right around your weight in pounds, right? So that's why as a person, if a person gets more obese, their dead space volume actually goes up, right? That's why obesity ultimately causes hypoxia, in a sense, if you really think about it in that way. But there are many other factors, but that's probably like a simple construct to use to understand that. So, and most people, you know, breathe at a respiratory rate of around like, I don't know, like 10 or 12. But let me just use 10 as a convenient number, just to make the math I'll talk about in a few seconds easy. So let me ask you a thinking question. What should be true of the alveolar ventilation and minute ventilation when you increase tidal volume? So I'll ask that question again. What should be true of your alveolar ventilation and minute ventilation when you increase tidal volume? Well, think about it. The dead space is essentially remaining constant, right? Because it's not like, oh, you add more bronchi or whatever. No, right? The dead space remains constant. So whenever you increase tidal volume above baseline, that will increase your alveolar ventilation and your minute ventilation at the same, basically at the same amount, right? So let me maybe use some numbers for this, right? So let's say your baseline tidal volume is 500 cc's, right? And your baseline respiratory rate is 10 breaths per minute. The minute ventilation for that person will be like 500 cc's per minute multiplied by the 10 breaths per minute. So that means their minute ventilation is like 5,000 cc's, or like 5 liters, 5,000 milliliters. And the baseline alveolar ventilation for those people, remember I said alveolar ventilation is subtract dead space ventilation. So let's say we take the tidal volume of 500 cc's, subtract the 150 cc's of dead space volume, right? We get 350. And then if we multiply that 350 by the respiratory rate of 10, right? That's an alveolar ventilation of like 3,500 cc's per minute, like 3.5 liters per minute. So let's assume we then increase the tidal volume above baseline, right? We increase it by 100, right? So we take the tidal volume from like 500 to 600, right? If you calculated the minute ventilation, you notice that the tidal volume is going up by 100, right? If you calculated, I guess, the increase in, let me make this a little simpler. If you calculated the increase in minute ventilation, you're essentially taking the bumped up tidal volume of 100 cc's. You multiply by the respiratory rate of 10, right? So that means the person's minute ventilation is going up by like 1,000 cc's. You're going from like 5,000 cc's to 6,000 cc's. If you did the same calculation for the person's alveolar ventilation, right? It should also go up by 1,000 cc's because you're bumping the tidal volume by 100 cc's. The respiratory rate is staying the same, right? So it's like, again, still the same 100 times 10. That's 1,000 cc's extra. So you're going from like 3,500 cc's to 4,500 cc's. So whenever the tidal volume, and you may say, Divine, this makes obvious sense. I promise you, your friends at the MBME can make up questions where this thing that makes obvious sense may look very confusing. So just stick with me here for a few minutes. So when you increase the tidal volume, the minute ventilation and the alveolar ventilation go up by the same amount, okay? They go up by the same amount. And the reason they go up by the same amount, if you're increasing tidal volume, is because the dead space volume stays constant. But now, let me go into the weeds a little. Let me ask you a follow-up question. What is true of the minute ventilation and the alveolar ventilation when you bump up the respiratory rate? What is true of the minute ventilation and the alveolar ventilation when you bump up the respiratory rate? Let's do some math here. The Cliff's Notes answer is that they both go up, but they don't go up by the same amount. So you may say, Divine, why does that make any sense? Notice, now I'm not changing the tidal volume. The thing I'm changing is the respiratory rate. So let me explain what happens here. So let's do the baseline calculations again. Mean ventilation, 500 cc's times 10 breaths per minute. That's 5,000 cc's per minute. Alveolar ventilation, you know, again, 500 minus 150, which is the dead space volume. So you get 350 times 10 breaths per minute. That's an alveolar ventilation of, you know, 3,500 cc's per minute. Now, let's assume we increase the respiratory rate to 15. If you calculate the minute ventilation, right, it's like 500 cc's for your tidal volume times the new respiratory rate of 15 breaths per minute. That is 7,500 cc's per minute. So essentially, the minute ventilation has increased from the baseline 5,000 to the new value of 7,500. So that's like an increase of 2,500 cc's per minute. Now, if you calculate the alveolar ventilation with the new respiratory rate, you have like the 350, right? So 500 minus 150, the 350 multiplied by 15. That is 5,250 cc's per minute, right? So if you compare that to the baseline 3,500, you've bumped by 1,750. So do you see that if you increase the respiratory rate, the alveolar ventilation does not increase to the same amount as the minute ventilation? It does not increase as fast as the minute ventilation. So you may say, Divine, why? If you really think about it, if you increase respiratory rate, you are also increasing the ventilation of the dead space, right? Because it's like you breathe more, you use your dead space. If you breathe faster, you use your dead space more, right? Again, I promise you, this is a critical concept you want to understand. It's something that's actually simple, but it's something that people kind of lose sight of, okay? So if you increase your respiratory rate, you're also increasing the ventilation of your dead space, right? So an increase in respiratory rate does not increase alveolar ventilation as much as it increases your minute ventilation. The reason your minute ventilation is increasing more is that by increasing your respiratory rate, your alveolar ventilation is increasing, but your dead space ventilation is also increasing as well, right? So that's, again, critical concept to keep at the back of your mind. So if, for example, they give you like a ventilator style question on the USMLE step one exam, or if, again, let's say you become like a critical care physician in the future, if you're managing a ventilator, a more high yield means of increasing alveolar ventilation is to actually bump the tidal volume up as against bumping the respiratory rate up, right? Because the alveolar ventilation just rises a lot more with increases in tidal volume than increases in respiratory rate. So I hope this makes sense. If it doesn't make sense, I will strongly encourage you to rewind this and listen to it again. It's a very critical concept to understand. So let me ask you like a slightly different question. What if you have two people that have identical minute ventilations, but they have different respiratory rates? Who have the higher alveolar ventilation? I'll say this again. Let's assume you have two people, they have identical minute ventilations, but they have different respiratory rates. Who should have the higher alveolar ventilation? I would hope that you are telling me it's the person that has the lower respiratory rate, right? So why does that make any sense? So let's use, again, a simple number. Let's say 5,000 cc's. So let's say we're comparing person X and person Y. Person X has a mini ventilation of 5,000 cc's. Person Y has a mini ventilation of 5,000 cc's. And then let's make the thing that we vary, the respiratory rate. So let's say person A has a respiratory rate of, I don't know, like 10. And person B has the respiratory rate of 20. Right, so person A having the respiratory rate of 10 means that his tidal volume has to be 500 cc's, right? Person B that has the respiratory rate of 20 means that his tidal volume has to be 250 cc's. So if you take the first person, person X tidal volume 500 cc's, person Y tidal volume 250 cc's. Right? Remember the dead space, let's say it's the same human being. The dead space is roughly the same between both people. If you subtract 150 cc's from 500 cc's, do you see that you are left with like an alveolar like you're left with a value of 350 for person X and a value of 100 for person Y. So if you take that value of 350 for person X, 100 for person Y, and then you multiply by the respiratory rates to get the alveolar ventilation, do you see that the person that has the lower respiratory rate has an alveolar ventilation of essentially like 35? So because the person is breathing at like 10 breaths per minute, the person has an alveolar ventilation of like 350 times 10. That's 3,500 cc's per minute. Well, the person that's breathing faster, right? Oh, the person is breathing real fast. You take their 100 and multiply by their faster rate, their faster breathing rate, like 20 breaths per minute. That's just 2,000 cc's per minute. So when you breathe faster, your alveoli actually do not get oxygenated better, okay? Especially if you're dealing with the same, if you're holding the minute ventilations constant. Again, you may say this is low yield, but these are those kinds of questions that the vast majority of people taking step one end up getting wrong, right? They will just essentially describe it as an experiment from the exam, and then you have to think through all this respiratory physiology, right? But again, it's simple if you really try to buckle down and understand it. They could very easily make this a multiple choice question and then mix and match things. They may say like, oh, so assuming you have two people with identical mini ventilations but different respiratory rate, who has the higher alveolar ventilation? And then they will start changing all the variables like, oh, the person with a respiratory rate of 20 and tidal volume of this, the person having the respiratory rate of this and tidal volume of that. So you can already see how in the heat of a USMLE step one exam with all that pressure, that can very effectively mess with your head. Okay, so the next concept I guess I'll go ahead and jump to is to talk about the types of respiration, right? The types of respiration. So you may say, Divine, what do you mean by types of respiration? Basically, I mean, I guess this is almost like a made-up concept, but I think of respiration as being one of three types. You either inspire, or you expire, or you forced expire, right? So inspire, right, means you're inspiring, you're bringing in air to your lungs, right? The things that help you accomplish those goals are your diaphragm and your external intercostals. That's high yield to know. Now, expiration in and of itself, like regular expiration, is a passive process. So essentially, if your diaphragm and your external intercostals stop contracting, things will return right back to normal, right? Expiration, normal quiet expiration, is a passive process. But let's say you want to do something called forced expiration. So you want to blow out that expiratory reserve volume I talked about earlier. You're going to need to get some additional help from your abdominal muscles, all right? And the abdominal muscles that you get extra help from are things like your external and internal oblique muscles, or your rectus and your transversus abdominis muscles. And I guess your internal intercostals also help with like forced expiration. So I actually learned this mnemonic or trick from my med school professor that taught me pulmonary physiology. Basically, he said to remember like which of the intercostals helps with expiration versus inspiration is just to remember that for inspiration, you use your internal intercostals. And for expiration, you use your external intercostals. So you just basically like take that mantra into your brain, like, oh, the I's match, the E's match. And then remember that that is wrong. Okay? So like, oh, for inspiration, I use my internal intercostals. For expiration, I use my external intercostals. And then remember that that is wrong. Essentially, take the opposite, and then you should be squared away. Because the truth is that for inspiration, you use your external intercostals. For expiration, you use your internal intercostals. Or you can just say, let me just remember one concept and take the opposites. Like, oh, for the I activity, for the inspiratory activity, I'm using the E word, your external intercostals. Or for the E activity, for expiration, I'm using the I word, internal intercostals. Then that can, whichever method floats your boat, that can help you keep things straight. Now, for the next phase of what I want to talk about, I just want to talk about almost like a series of thought experiments to again establish the mechanisms behind a person inspiring, like getting air into the lungs, and a person expiring, that's getting air out of the lungs. So this is one area where you just want to try to follow my series of statements. If I were you, I'll listen to a short part of this, pause, run it through your head and make sure it makes sense to you. Okay? Now, my first statement is that the lung likes to recoil inward. Okay? The lung likes to recoil inward, right? Essentially, your alveoli contains elastic tissues. Those elastic tissues make the lungs recoil inward. So the natural tendency of the lungs is to recoil inward. Okay, so it's kind of like a balloon, right? If you blow up a balloon, right, the natural thing the balloon wants to do is to deflate, right? It wants to deflate, it wants to recoil right back, it wants to recoil inwards. Now, at higher lung volumes, the desire of your lungs to recoil inwards increases. I'll say that again. At higher lung volumes, the desire of your lungs to recoil inward increases. Again, just kind of compare this to a balloon. If you compare like a balloon that's just a little inflated to one that's maximally inflated, the maximally inflated balloon, right, will want to recoil inward more, right? You will have a bigger desire to recoil inward. So remember that statement, and then you can essentially like take the corollary to that, right? If the desire to recoil inward is less for a lung that is not maximally inflated, right? So let me essentially just again explain this a different way. Recoil, or I guess introduce a new concept with this. Recoil is synonymous to elastance. Okay, so if a lung is at high volumes, right, so it's, again, think of this as like a maximally inflated balloon, the elastance is very high. So elastance is highest when the lung is at its highest volume, when the lung is maximally distended, right? So there is a greater propensity to snap back when the lung is at its highest volume. So like your total lung capacity, for example. And the second concept I want you to keep in mind is that compliance is inversely proportional to elastance. The thing is, if I were you, I would just try to understand, I mean, because I've essentially introduced this concept as elastance, talking about like, oh, the lung wanting to recoil inwards. Just remember that direction and then just take the opposites and you can derive any concept you need for compliance. So I've talked about the lungs. Now, what about the chest wall? The thing is, the chest wall loves to recoil outwards. Okay, the chest wall loves to recoil outwards. But the problem there is that, yes, the lungs wants to recoil inwards, the chest wall wants to recoil outwards. The problem is that the chest wall is tethered to the lung itself by pleura, okay? The chest wall is tethered to the lung itself by pleura. So you essentially have like two forces that are competing against each other, right? Like the chest wall wants to recoil out, the alveoli won't like to recoil in, right? So the thing is, when you have these two forces counterbalancing each other, right? So you essentially like hit a stalemate, like this outward recoil of the chest wall, inward recoil of the lungs. When you have these two forces counterbalancing each other, the lung will be at FRC. Your lung will be at the functional residual capacity. So essentially, the equilibrium volume of the lung, basically, again, like I said, the FRC, is determined by these two forces. And again, you'll see how these concepts all relate when I begin to talk about pulmonary pathologies. Now, the next concept I want to establish is the whole concept of flow, right? There's such a thing as flow, right? But there's also such a thing as pressure. And the thing is, for respiratory physiology, always think about pressure as a relative term. Essentially, you're typically trying to compare like two pressures. Like you're typically comparing like, oh, one pressure that is bigger than the other, right? You're typically comparing like a side with a pressure that is higher than another side. Now, for flow to happen, you need to have some kind of pressure differential. A pressure differential must exist for flow to happen, right? Because, I mean, if you think about it logically, right, things flow from higher pressures to lower pressures, right? The thing that typically flows is essentially like a fluid of some sort, right? Remember, the word fluid literally means you have the ability, you have the capacity to flow, right? So the things that flow are either like gases or liquids, right? A fluid just means either a gas or a liquid. So now that I've sort of talked about these, let me introduce because I kind of wanted to use that as a foundation to talk about the concept of positive versus negative pressure. Okay. The thing is, a system that a system being at positive pressure means that the pressure within that system exceeds the pressure in the surroundings around that system. So let me talk about that again. So a system that is at positive pressure means that the pressure inside that system exceeds the pressures outside that system. Conversely, a system that is at negative pressure means that the pressure inside the system, so the pressure within the system, is exceeded by the pressures that exist outside that system. So if you're kind of following along with all these statements I've been making, it should make sense, right, that flow should happen away from positive pressure and towards negative pressure, right? I mean, if you want to maybe find, I guess, a more convenient way of stating this is that nature abhors a vacuum, right? So you always want to bring things back to equilibrium. You can bring things back to equilibrium by having pressure, having like flow happen away from the positive pressure side of things and towards the negative pressure side of things. So let me give you an example, right? Like a real life example, right? If you blow air into a straw, right? The pressure within that straw will go up above atmospheric pressure. And you will notice on the other end of the straw, air will flow out of that straw, right? Because by blowing air into the straw, you are making that the lumen, the inside of that straw, be a positive pressure system, because the pressure inside it will be higher than the pressures of the surrounding atmosphere. But on the other hand, let's assume you suck at a straw, right? When you suck out a straw, you let all the air out of that straw. That the lumen, like the inside of that straw, becomes a negative pressure system, because the pressure on the outside will be higher than the pressure on the inside. Okay? That is why flow from your drink will go into the straw under those circumstances, because your drink that surrounds that air, that straw lumen that you've sucked air out of, that straw lumen will be at lower pressures on the inside relative to the drink that is kind of like at atmospheric pressures, so you'll have higher pressures, right? So that's why when you sip on a drink, that drink flows into the straw, because by that initial sip, you get all the air out of the straw, so the straw, the lumen of the straw, becomes a negative pressure system. Now, when you decide to essentially take, like, you know, like make your own standard and you say, you know what, I want to compare pressures on the inside to pressures on the outside. So again, we're dealing with like a system, like a closed system, if you may. If you say, you know what, let me make my standard to compare pressures on the inside to pressures on the outside, you're essentially delving into the realm of something called a transmural pressure, okay? Basically, the transmural pressure for any system is essentially the pressure difference from subtracting the pressure on the outside from the pressure on the inside. So if you want to like express this as like a, you know, like a logical equation, transmural pressure is inside pressure minus outside pressure. I mean, stated conveniently, like, a transmural pressure is like the pressure that's pushing on the walls of an enclosure, okay? Is the pressure that is pushing on the walls of an enclosure. So for a positive pressure system, right, you should kind of be able to deduce that the transmural pressure has to be some positive number, right? Because the pressure inside the system exceeds the pressure outside the system, right? And I mean, the reverse should also be the case, right? If you have like a negative transmural pressure, it should mean that the pressure on the outside of the system exceeds the pressure on the inside of the system, right? So that essentially makes that system collapse inwards. Now, so I guess let me summarize. If you have a positive transmural pressure, that will cause outward expansion of a system, right? Because again, the pressure within the system exceeds the pressure outside. Conversely, if you have a negative transmural pressure, it will cause that system to collapse because the pressure within that system is less than the pressure outside. Again, you may see divine, these are all logical things, these are all simple things, but you'll see how they all cut across pulmonary pathology when we begin to talk about those things. And one thing I've noticed is if you have a deep understanding of things like at this level, when you see MBME questions, they become very easy because you essentially see through what the examiner is trying to lay in front of you. That's why, again, I always tell people, in everything you do, always try to seek understanding. understanding bits memorization every day of the week. So now that I've talked about all these statements, let me begin to make parallels with the respiratory system, right? But before I start making those parallels, I want you to keep a construct at the back of your mind. Think of your lungs as being the insides of your respiratory system, and then think of the pleural space as being the outside of your respiratory system. You'll see what I mean going forward. So think of your lungs like your alveoli, like the inside of your alveoli as like the inside, and then think of your pleural space as being the outside. Now, let me talk about that. I've been saying plural. What does plural mean, right? Basically, the pleura is a sheet of tissue that's essentially like folded back on itself. Remember, I told you that the pleura tethers the lungs to the chest wall. So the pleura is a sheet of tissue that's, you know, essentially folded back on itself. The inward part of this fold is what is tethered to the lung. That's like your visceral pleura. The outward part of this fold is tethered to the chest wall. That's essentially your parietal pleura. The space between this inward fold and the outward fold is your pleural space, okay? And many times you'll hear people throw around the term that, oh, this space is at negative pressure. Basically, what they mean is that the surroundings of the pleural space generally have higher pressures than the pleural space itself. So the pressure within the pleural space is always, in general, is always less than the pressures of surrounding spaces. So, I mean, this should kind of make logical sense, right? Think about this in the context of transmural pressures. At rest for the lungs, we know that our alveoli are not collapsed, right? We know that our alveoli are open. For those alveoli to be open, right, because essentially they're expanding outwards, it should kind of make sense that the pressure within those alveoli, right, should be higher than the pressures outside those alveoli, essentially like in the pleural space, right? So the pressures on the outside of the alveoli, again, the pleural space pressure should be less than the pressures inside the alveoli. Now, another thing I guess I want you to realize is that, remember I said that, again, everyone says that, oh, your pleural space is at negative pressure, your pleural space is at negative pressure, pleural space is at negative pressure, right? It means that, again, surroundings of the pleural space tend to be at higher pressures than the pleural space itself, right? So I already said that, oh, your alveoli at rest are usually kind of like held open. So that means the pressures within your alveoli exceed your pleural pressures. The same is also true for the atmosphere. The atmospheric pressure is usually greater than the pressure within the pleural space. Okay. So in other words, again, relative to the surrounding atmosphere, your pleural space is at negative pressure. So let me summarize all these things again. Let me summarize these high yield relative pressures. The pressure in the alveoli is higher than the pressure in the pleural space. That's concept one. Concept two is that the pressure in the atmosphere is also higher than the pressure in the pleural space. And in respiratory physiology, we set the atmospheric pressure to be zero. Typically, we set the pleural pressure to be around like -5. Okay? So if you look at the situation when the lung is at rest, if the lung is at rest, so basically like there's no flow of air into the, like the lung is just, you know, at equilibrium, there's no airflow into the lungs, like basically like what happens when you inspire, right? So again, like just lung at rest, air is not coming in, air is not going out. It should make sense that the pressure within the alveoli should kind of be the same as the pressure in the atmosphere, right? Because if the lung, again, at equilibrium, at FRC, at functional residual capacity, air is not coming in, air is not going out, there is no flow between the atmosphere and the insides of your alveoli, that means that there is no pressure differential, right? So that means at that point, the atmospheric pressure is zero, and the alveolar pressure is also zero. So at that resting point, just sort of think of it like time lapse, at that resting point, if you calculated the transmural pressure of the alveoli relative to the pleura, if you get a value of 5, right, because the pressure inside the alveoli is zero, the pressure outside the alveoli, right, within the pleural space is -5, as I said. So if you take 0 minus -5, that is +5, right? And again, because it's a positive transmural pressure, that means it's a pressure that is tending to keep the alveoli open, which is what you want. If your alveoli are collapsed, you'll have a big problem because you will not be able to get, you'll have a hard time performing a gas exchange. So now that we've talked about all these things, let's sort of talk about the process of getting air into the lungs, the process of inspiration. When your diaphragm and your external intercostal muscles contracts, right, your pleural pressure actually gets more negative. So essentially, it becomes like a value that's more negative than negative 5. So let's say like negative 7, for example. If you think about it, if the pleural pressures become, like your intrapleural pressures, become more negative, what should happen to the transmural pressure between the alveoli and the pleural space? It should increase, right? Because if you take that, oh, you're like, oh, my alveoli is at 0 and my intrapleural pressure is negative 5 initially, that the spread is positive 5. But if, you know, your external intercostal muscles contract, your diaphragm contracts, your intrapleural pressure can go from like negative 5 to like negative 7, for example. If you take that 0 within the alveoli minus negative 7, you come up with a new transmural pressure of positive 7. So, that transmural pressure goes up when your intrapleural pressure, like your pleural pressure, gets more negative. And again, like I said, as transmural pressure is increasing, right, that means you're exerting more force on the walls of like the surrounding container. So that means the alveoli should expand, right? Because again, if our transmural pressure again is becoming more positive, it means that enclosure, that system is expanding, okay? And think about it, when the alveoli expands, what is intrinsically happening to their volume? Their volumes are going up, right? And if the volume is increasing, what is happening to the pressure within the alveoli? If you're thinking about like Boyle's law, the pressure within the alveoli should be decreasing, right? Because as volume goes up, right, gas molecules are farther apart, so the pressure within that system should go down, right? So the pressure should decrease. So with the alveolar volume increasing, the alveolar pressure is decreasing, right? So for a moment in time, your alveolar pressure transiently like dips below the atmospheric pressure. If the pressure within your alveoli dips below the atmospheric pressure, then that will cause air to flow into the lungs, right? The air will rush into the lungs because, again, like I said, nature wants equilibrium, so the air rushing in will essentially equalize the pressures between the insides of the alveoli and the atmosphere, right? So basically, when you have a negative intrapleural, like a more negative intrapleural pressure, the transmural pressure between the alveoli and the pleural space will increase, right? So the alveoli will expand. When the alveoli expands, the alveolar volume goes up. If the volume goes up, according to Boyle's law, the alveolar pressure will come down. When the alveolar pressure comes down, you essentially have like a negative pressure system between the atmosphere and the lungs, because the atmosphere, like, because the atmosphere itself will have higher pressures than the lungs, so air will flow down, right, from high pressure to low pressure to fill up the lungs. That's essentially what happens in inspiration. If you take the negative, if you take the opposite of everything I've just described, you already understand the mechanism behind expiration. So I know this has kind of gone on for long, so I'm going to go ahead and pause here. And again, you may see, Divine, this podcast is very typical. But again, I promise you, if you understand everything that I have described in this podcast, most of the other podcasts that will come after this, where I again begin to go more direct, like I'm a little more like direct and less like abstract, where I begin to go like more direct into like talking about like this physiology and this pathology and this pathology and that pathology, they will all just flow nicely in your brain because you already have this foundation down pat. So as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer again one-on-one tutoring for essentially every exam you take as a medical student. So I offer tutoring for the USMLE Step 1, Step 2 CK, Step 2 CS, and Step 3 exams. I tutor for the preclinical med school exams, the third year like clinical shelf exams. And then if you're a medicine resident, I tutor to the medicine board exams and the internal medicine in-training exam. And then if you're a college student, I actually tutor for like a tutor like Gen Chem, O-Chem, physiology, histology, biochemistry, all that stuff. And then I also do like one-on-one like advising slash I guess consultant for like med students applying to a residency, so like an ERASAP, or like a college student applying to med school, so an AMCASAP. Again, I have like admissions committee experience, so I've worked with lots and lots of people that have applied for either of these things. And again, the vast majority of people I've worked with have been very successful. And also this whole concept of longitudinal tutoring, I also offer that, where you're studying med school, I tutor you through your preclinical exams. But as I'm tutoring you for your preclinical exams, I'm infusing step one knowledge with each of those blocks, so that when you get to your dedicated period, you feel like very well prepared, super ready for step one. Because unfortunately, there is, at most med schools, there's a dissonance between what is thought in med school for your coursework and what you're expected to know ultimately for step one. So this longitudinal tutoring essentially bridges that gap, and it helps you like in two ways. It helps you crush your preclinical exams, but it also helps you be ready for step one when it rolls along. Usually those people also tutor them during their dedicated periods. I do the same thing for third year med students. Again, longitudinal tutoring, I tutor you for each of your shelf exams. As I'm doing that, again, I'm infusing knowledge that is pertinent to step two CK. So that again, when you hit your step two CK dedicated period, you're like super ready, you're very well prepared, right? So if you need any of those things, again, reach out to me either through the website or reach out to me through like an email, like divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. And I guess as an update to the website, like over the last like 1 or 2 weeks, there is a section you may see at the top called podcast topics. It essentially breaks things down by tag, right? So it's just much easier to navigate that way. So if you go to the main website and you click on podcast topics, let's say you're trying to study step one nephrology, right? You'll see like a section that says your seminar step one. You'll see like a tab down that says nephrology. You click on that and you'll see like everything that is like every podcast that is renal related that I have made for the USMLE step one exam. Hopefully over the next couple of days, 2 weeks, I get to a point where these podcasts are moved to, or not necessarily moved, but are accessible through like a podcast app. So like Spotify, for example. So I will try really hard to make that happen. And also like, again, kind of long term, over the next few weeks, I will try to get the podcasts to my YouTube channel. Because right now on my YouTube channel, I just have my videos on there. I will try to put like these podcasts on YouTube so that you can, again, access these things across multiple platforms like Spotify, the YouTube channel, and the website, whichever floats your boat. So have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you. I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you.